All right, we're continuing this morning in this, to me, it's been a very interesting study, an interesting series, and I hope you're finding it interesting as well, that we are looking at big-time mistakes, errors that people have made that have been quite costly to these biblical characters, and we're trying to extract as much as we can so that we can avoid the same consequences, the same kind of earthquake proportion disasters that result when you make these mistakes. And this morning we're going to take a look at sibling rivalry as it is showcased in the lives of Jacob and Esau. And so in chapter 25 we get the introduction to these two men in verse 21. Isaac is their father here, and it starts with, Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren. The Lord answered his prayer, and his wife Rebekah became pregnant. The babies jostled each other within her, and she said, why is this happening to me? So she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger. When the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. The first to come out was red, and his whole body was like a hairy garment, so they named him Esau. And after this, his brother came out with his hand grasping Esau's heel, so he was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when Rebekah gave birth to them. The boys grew up, and Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the open country, while Jacob was a quiet man staying among the tents. Isaac, who had a taste for wild game, loved Esau, but Rebekah loved Jacob. All right, we're going to stop there for a moment and consider this passage. We have a really unusual event unfolding here, even from the conception of these children, God is commenting on their different natures, their different futures. He's discussing that they'll become two nations. There's obviously a divergence that's going to be happening here between these two boys. Part of the question as to this thought process this morning then is, did God manipulate this? Is God controlling these men's lives? Is he having them struggle even in the womb, and they really don't have much say about this? I would tend to answer no to that. It seems as though God, in his knowledge and his wisdom, sees what's unfolding and is discussing, but I don't see any hint that he is directly manipulating these men, that he is like treating them like puppets or marionettes pulling the strings, and they don't really have a say in what's going on. The Lord may foresee circumstances and foretell, but that does not eliminate the human factor and the variables of human decision. So these men are, it seems, going to act of their own accord and suffer the consequences or the results. We do see a big mistake made here by their parents, especially in verse 28, we have Isaac and Rebekah mentioned as showing favoritism, it seems, or a tendency to shower love and attention more on one child than the other. We know as parents that this is a very dangerous thing to do. Our kids are constantly looking, testing, observing to see if there's any favoritism, any special attention paid. The children always have this kind of fairness radar running, you know, and they're always observing. It's even when they're little children and they're looking at the amount of food that they got on their plate, you know, they're running some kind of computer algorithm that's telling them whether or not the amount of food is an adequate indication of their parents' love. And then, of course, if they detect something wrong, they got more than I did, you know, that kind of stuff. It's constant. And it seems like in a young person's life, they have a very difficult time balancing on that fine line, you know, between self-worth and arrogance, right? And so a child will oftentimes fall into the trap of thinking, I'm more loved or I'm more important than my sibling. Or they might go the other direction and fall off and toward the attitude that says, well, they like them more than me. And, you know, these kind of little mind games are running all the time. It's obviously then a parent's prerogative to try to reinforce again and again, we love you all. We don't try to show favoritism. But you know, in the scriptures, we have some instances where favoritism seems to be shown. You know, we have Joseph's coat of many colors. You know, that's like a classic where, you know, he's the favorite son and he gets this special garment to indicate the love of the father, you know. And here again, we see it's pretty clearly laid out for us that there is a parental choice being made which child they're closer to. Now, let's admit it. If you have a child that's rebellious and has a difficult personality, and that, yes, it's very hard to show them the same kind of emotional attention and feeling as with a child that's very compliant and easygoing. It can be very challenging. But of course, a godly parent's going to do their utmost to reinforce again and again that we don't play favorites and we're not trying to pretend as though one person's more important than the other. But, you know, some parents are better at this than others. And it seems as though there was a little bit of an alignment here between Esau and Jacob and Esau and Isaac, and then on the other hand, Rebecca and Jacob. And the two personalities of the boys came into this too, as it was discussed that Esau was a man's man. He was the hunter and lived in the open country kind of thing. And then we have Jacob, a quiet man, staying among the tents. I can imagine he would have watched the fashion channel. You know what I mean? He probably would have been a fan of Project Runway or something like that, right? You know? And so there's this natural divergence that's happening here. Even from the womb, little tussling going on even in the womb, such that Rebecca's asking, what's going on here? You know, this must have been Greco-Roman wrestling, you know, in utero or something. I don't know. Very weird. But this is a dangerous thing, to take sides and allegiances. And so this ends up influencing these two boys even further and causes more of a rift to form instead of togetherness. You know, there are weird, unusual things that take place with siblings, you know. And some come out and they come from the same parents and the same gene pool, and they're like the two peas in a pod, and they're best friends, you know? But then you have other siblings, and it's like fire and ice. It's like the sandpaper and silk, and, you know, just can't get things together, you know? And yet, boy, is it harmful. If parents start to form allegiances and alliances, then things really go south. So this was not good on the parts of the parents. And sometimes this shows weaknesses in the marriages themselves. Sometimes when husband and wife don't get along all that well, it comes out in the other relationships in the family, especially in cases of divorce when children are used like little pawns in a war where the kids are sent to, you know, deliver messages to the other spouse, or gifts are lavished on children in order to evoke jealousy or anger. You know, all kinds of game playing that's happening. So this might be a little telltale clue to us that maybe Isaac and Rebecca's marriage wasn't always so smooth either, you know. But be that as it may, we have these two guys that are not getting along. They don't seem to have much interest in common. And so in verse 29 through 34, we see a crisis point in their relationship. Once when Jacob was cooking some stew, Esau comes in from the open country. Of course, he's an open country kind of guy, right? He probably would have ridden his quad back, you know. And so he's famished. He said to Jacob, "Quick, let me have some of that red stew. I'm famished." That's why it's also called Edom. The word Edom means red, okay? And so he was red and hairy when he was born, and they have this incident with the red-colored stew, so this becomes his nickname, Edom, all right? So Jacob replies, "First, sell me your birthright." How did we get from "I'm famished, give me some food" to "sell me your birthright"? Obviously, there is a lack of consideration and respect and unity with these two siblings. You can tell this had been going on a long time. You can also tell that Jacob has designs on leadership and taking what is Esau's. There's no respect going on here between these two. The one comes in, "Give me some of that food, I'm hungry." The other one says, "Oh yeah, I'll do it for your birthright." You know, this is, they're not getting along. And you know what, at one point we look at this and we say, Jacob, what a scumbag, huh? Playing on his older brother's hunger. People get rangy. They get weird when they get hungry. Have you noticed that? Have you ever seen members in your family? Have you ever noticed the patterns of members in your family? After a while, you can tell, we don't go near this person. We don't deal with this person at certain times, right? Unless they've had food or unless they've had rest, we just leave them alone, okay? And this is what's going on here. So Jacob is kind of conniving here. He's a weaseler. You know, when he came out of the womb with his hand affixed to the heel of his slightly older brother, who just preceded him out of the birth canal, right? He is grabbing onto the heel. That's what the name Jacob means, the one who grasps, or it can be also said to be supplanter, the one who overthrows, okay? Because he's trying to trip up and grab at the heel of his brother, see? And sure enough, that's exactly what he's doing here. He's going after his brother again. And we're thinking, well, that's kind of scummy, you know? Where he's spending his time trying to find ways to take what's his brother's. Shouldn't his older brother be blessed, and shouldn't he be proud and happy, and shouldn't he be able to let his brother be the older and inherit the birthright? You see, in that culture, the oldest son carried on the tradition of the family and was given a double blessing materially as the oldest to carry on the family lineage. He would be given a double inheritance, see? And he would also receive a spiritual blessing from his father. Well, Jacob's not content with this, especially because he doesn't see eye to eye with his brother. So he's about to try to take it. And he's going to play on Esau's gruff kind of rash mindset in order to try to conduct a deal for it. See? Oh, I tell you, sometimes siblings can be really sly and try to weasel and work things. This, he is not blessing his brother here. He is doing wrong to his brother here. But it's going to be all legal and technically correct. See? All right. So Esau, in verse 32, "Look, I'm about to die. What good is the birthright to me?" But Jacob says, "Swear to me first." See, Jacob is trying to get Esau put in a position where if he swears to this and takes an oath to it, then it will be binding. To the ancients, your oath was critical. When you swore to something before God, then it meant you were bound to it. And of course, what about Esau? In verse 34, verse 33. So Jacob said, swear to me first. So he swore an oath to him, selling his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and lentil stew. He ate and drank, and he got up and left. So Esau despised his birthright. Now we start to see that Jacob's not the only kind of scummy guy in this situation. Esau also has some issues. In fact, if we were to turn for a second to the book of Hebrews, keep your spot back in Genesis, but in Hebrews, page 1878, Hebrews chapter 12, what of a guy who would sell his birthright, his spiritual blessing, for a bowl of stew? Well, that is soundly condemned in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 16. He is held up as an example. See that no one is sexually immoral or is godless like Esau, who for a single meal sold his inheritance rights as the oldest son. Afterward, as you know, when he wanted to inherit his blessing, he was rejected. He could bring about no change of mind, though he sought the blessing with tears. Oh, then he wanted it. Once it was too late. But back before, when discussing it with his brother Jacob, he did not care enough about the importance of that spiritual blessing and the birthright as the oldest son in order to protect it, especially if his younger brother had fashions to take it from him. What does this say about Esau? It is very possible that Esau had thin respect for God and for his parents' spirituality. How else would you explain someone willing to trade away your entire spiritual future and family heritage for a bowl of food? The sad truth is that sometimes young people, maybe in their late teens or early 20s, get this mindset that they don't necessarily respect the values of their parents. And they've got a different idea of how life should work. And they might not care less what their parents have to say. They get this notion that somehow, because they've lived all of 18 or 20-some years, they're genius, and now they're going to set their own course. And, you know, they would fairly just leave what their parents have designed and set for them. And no, thank you, I'll go my own direction. Maybe that was Esau's attitude. And if that was his attitude, then he did not have a healthy relationship with God. The birthright was critical. You held on to it like a young person should hold on to their virginity. It was absolutely important. For him to just toss it aside like that showed thin respect toward God, maybe even disdain toward God. No wonder then, in Hebrews, that it said that he was godless. He was behaving more like a pagan than a person of God. So now we see both the boys have major problems. Jacob's got issues with trying to take power and control, and Esau's got problems with lack of respect toward God and his parents. Well, then you can see why this is a volatile mix and why things are not going to go very well here, okay? So go back to Genesis chapter 33. Now, you know, Rebekah helped Jacob to swindle away and take away that birthright. Jacob ended up getting that birthright. And afterwards, Esau was so angry, he likely would have killed his brother. And that's why Jacob flees. And he flees to stay with his uncle Laban. And that's where a couple of weeks ago, on Valentine's Day, we told the story of how Jacob falls in love with Rachel and ends up working 14 years at Uncle Laban's place, right? So it's at least like a decade and a half that time passes that Jacob and Esau don't see each other. Maybe this is enough time for Esau's anger to cool. 15 years minimum? Well, it seems like after his time is put in with Uncle Laban, Jacob leaves with his wives, you have to read that whole story in Genesis, but he leaves and he sends a message to Esau. Maybe he's testing the waters. Maybe he's seeing whether things have settled down between him and his brother. So in Genesis chapter 33, we have in We're going to skip back to chapter 32 for a second in verse 6. 32 verse 6. He sends messengers to contact his brother Esau in verse 6. When the messengers returned to Jacob, they said, "We went to your brother Esau, and now he's coming to meet you with 400 men. Okay, why does brother need 400 men to come meet me? Could this be a small army? This is an unnerving thought to Jacob. And so he immediately starts to divvy up his family and possessions, and he prepares a special entourage of little groups to go to meet Esau bearing gifts for him. So Jacob is into full appeasement mode at this point. So he's sending these gifts that will come to meet Esau. And when they meet, in chapter 33, we pick it up, Jacob looked up, and there was Esau coming with his 400 men. So he divides the children into groups, and he has different groups that are going to meet him. In verse 3, notice how Jacob meets his brother. He himself went on ahead and bowed down to the ground 7 times as he approached his brother. What does this mean? Bowing down 7 times. Well, I think the message is somewhat along the effects of, "Hey, brother, I'm trying to be really humble here, huh? No harm, brother? Huh? Huh?" You know how that goes. In the past, he had proven himself a major threat to Esau's welfare. Now he's like, hey, everything's good? Everything's cool? Right? But look at Esau. In verse 4, Esau ran to meet Jacob and embraced him. He threw his arms around his neck and kissed him, and they wept. It's a loving reunion. But isn't it interesting the way the two men approach each other? Jacob is very cautious, very cool about this. Esau, who does Esau remind you of? You know, he reminds me of the father in the parable of the prodigal son. Or the loving father, right? Where there'd been this disconnect, this falling out, and the father comes racing toward his son who is screwed up, who has caused so much pain and grief, and the father's forgiven all of this. And he doesn't care if the world watches him as he runs toward his son and embraces him and forgives him, and then has this celebration that they're reunited once again. The love of that father in that story, of course, is the same love that God shows toward us. This forgiveness, this overwhelming acceptance despite our failures and mistakes. That's what God's showing to us in Christ. God runs to us and receives us back despite the pain we've caused. And that's exactly where Esau was at. All that time had given him a chance for his anger to dissipate. He let it go. And now he was racing toward his brother to hug him and receive him. And yet it wasn't all patched over. This was a critical moment. It could have been a defining turning point in their relationship that could have seen restoration, but it wasn't going to happen. You can tell that somewhat in the language that is used when they are talking to each other. Jacob just isn't ready for this. If you take a look at verse 8 in chapter 33, Esau asked, "What do you mean by all these droves I met?" Notice Jacob's answer, "To find favor in your eyes, my Lord." Now, this isn't Lord with a capital L. This is not trying to confuse Esau with God or anything. The word Lord with a small L meant superior or master in a sense, someone who was over you. My Lord would be the official term that would be used of someone who was a citizen toward a king or toward a governor, all right? So Jacob is trying to use a term of respect, trying to show deference to his older brother Esau by saying, my Lord. This is quite formal. This is showing that Jake, in Jacob's mind, this isn't like two brothers getting together. This is sort of like two people on vastly different planes that are meeting here. But notice in verse 9, Esau's comment. I already have plenty, my brother. The one is using more like political and social terms. The other one's using familial terms. And this shows us these guys are not coming together here. And then we see that it's not going to happen because Esau says, you know what? I'm going to return towards Seir, the area where I live. Why don't you come along with us and we'll all head towards Seir? You've left Laban's place. You don't have anywhere really to settle yet. Come along. We'll all live there. And Jacob's got all kinds of excuses. Well, oh, I can't travel with you guys, man. My sheep, my animals are very young. They can't be driven hard in this climate. And I've got young kids and all. They can't move at the same pace as 400 men. And so then Esau says in verse 15, well, then let me leave some of my men with you. You know, give a hand. No, don't do that. In verse 15. But why do that? No, just let me find favor in the eyes of my Lord. No, don't bother yourself. No. We'll end up catching up to you. But notice what it says in verse 16. So that day Esau started on his way back to Seir, and Jacob, however, went to Succoth, where he built a place for himself and made shelters for his livestock. He never did go to Seir. There never was this patching up and change of direction in their relationship. And you wonder, what was it? You know, was Jacob really that scummy? Or did he see something in Esau, even after all these years, was there something in Esau that kind of told Jacob he's never really going to be faithful to God? You know, for all of Jacob's shortcomings, he's really dialed in and toned, you know, tuned to God. And maybe he saw still that in his brother, he was never going to have that spiritual commitment to the Lord. And it would jeopardize this if he'd go back and stay with him. We don't know. But these two never got together. We do see them both again at the death of Isaac, at his graveside. And that's about the way the relationship goes between these two siblings. And it's so tragic. Because they could have shared in the inheritance. They could have shared in the blessings of God. But you know, as it is, God's ways are very mysterious. And even from the grave, the older would serve the younger. The birthright would fall to the youngest. God does that to demonstrate to us that his plan of salvation is under his control, not ours. And he can do things his way, not our way. But how sad for these two guys that they never really had that two peas in a pod relationship. They never had that closeness. But there were seeming mistakes made along the way. The favoritism of the parents. The lack of an authentic attempt to really reunite and get together once again on the part of Jacob. Now, I know there's families in our congregation, and you know people too, where the siblings just butt heads and don't get along. You know, if we can avoid favoritism as much as lies within us, we can help prevent some of this. But the other thing is, it falls on the siblings at some point to make a decision. And usually there's one or two chances in life where you get the opportunity to say, you know what, are we going to put this aside? Are we going to change things or not? We have to make our decision. Some will. Some will find common ground and try to start a new relationship and get things going in a different direction. Others won't, and they'll end up divergent the rest of their lives. There is a lot of mystery to it, isn't there? Why siblings? Some can make it together and get along, and some don't. You know, this is a very real story about human relationships and family. And I think there were some big mistakes made along the way. God willing, if we can avoid favoritism and if we can try to find common ground and forgiveness and receive one another, we don't have to end up living these disparate lives. You know that Esau ended up being the father of the Edomites. And the Edomites and the Israelites ended up hostile, enemies toward each other. We don't want our children to end up enemies. And with wisdom and an attempt at forgiveness and reconciliation, they can join in God's blessing together as opposed to be oppositional to one another. Amen.